This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. This is Q, the podcast. Highlights from the October 30th edition of Q, the program. Okay, on your podcast today, Andre Serrano, the celebrated New York visual artist behind Piss Christ, courts controversy wherever he goes. His photography focuses on sex, death, and religious iconography. And a new exhibit in Sweden was recently the target of vandals. I ask him about that when he joins me from our New York studio. And Dave Bedini, his band The Rio Statics, wrapped up recently after a 27-year run. So he went solo and has a new book entitled Around the World in 57 and a Half Gigs. He's first up. Holy Mackinac, you. This is Q. Okay. Well, when it comes to touring in a rock band, going on the road has its own charms. Sharing a vehicle with unwashed colleagues, seeing tiny glimpses of local color, and if you're lucky, performing in front of fans who know you and sing out your lyrics. But rocker and author Dave Bedini wanted to do things a little differently. With the end of his iconic Canadian band, the Rio Statics, on the horizon, he decided to take the road less traveled. So he designed a world tour to places no one would know him, where he just was some Canadian guy with a guitar. And that attitude of adventure marks the journey in his newest book, Around the World in 57 and a Half Gigs, a memoir that puts a new spin on the rock and roll tradition of being on the road. And Dave Bedini is with me now live in Studio Q. Hello, sir.
Great to be here.
Very good to have you here.
I like the format change. You know, the mighty. I expect a classic rock, but it's nice to
see
local joke.
You're a Toronto guy.
Yeah.
Don't alienate the rest of the country.
Well, there's a bear or a fox equivalent across the country.
There
people,
is. There is.
Know what I mean.
There's a radio station, of course, in Toronto called Q107, but we are not that Q. We're a different Q.
Right.
Great book.
Thanks.
Very entertaining. But and it's interesting what you did. The Rio Statics were breaking up. You were having all sorts of feelings about that. And you decide to create a tour for yourself where you'd literally be starting out all over again, going to unlikely places where no one would know you. Why?
It's funny, because in the intro you said that I sort of went solo, but I kind of went lonesome, I think is probably a better way of putting it. I figured if the band was ending, then it was done, and I wanted to get back to square one. I just wanted to be a guy with a guitar, you know? And funny, you know, we often, the band always waxed romantic about that first tour in 87, subsequent tours in 88 and 89, how you'd show up to like 12 people and really have to prove yourself, because nobody knew who you were. And it would be a blank slate. And they were sort of the fondest memories of great gigs in a way. I mean, big gigs too with lots of screen people are nice as well. But those pure moments, you know. So I thought it would be a challenge to myself as a musician, because you know what it's like in a band. You kind of get used to, you rely on the Marshall stacks and the, you know, the 29-tom drum kit.
Yeah. And the other guys on stage.
And the other guys on stage. And
it was catchy if you're following.
Yeah. And I wanted to be frightened. I wanted to be fearful of that moment of stepping on stage again, get back to that sensation and find out whether I liked it or not.
Now, Dave, it is part of the book, and I want to get to the tour, but on the Rio Statics ending, you say in the book that you really did have mixed feelings about this. You were angry for a while that the band was coming to an end.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you felt like you needed to do something as different as possible to deal with those feelings.
I think so. Yeah, and it was partly therapy as well. You know, I mean, getting on a train with your guitar and just going anywhere is therapeutic enough, let alone coming on the heels of a band that's been around for 25 years. It's a huge part of my life, having ended. And when Tim told us in that hotel room in Edmonton that he was quitting, it was a really dark, you know, feeling in the pit of my stomach, like the worst possible feelings. But not soon after that, I realized that I could sort of, that was an opportunity for me, I suppose, to explore mm-hmm. something different musically, create something different musically. But it wasn't, no, I don't think it was a conscious attempt artistically to do something completely different. It was just more of an aesthetic choice, I suppose.
If you had your druthers at that point, Rheostatics would have continued. You just would have kept going?
Yeah, I kind of always liked the idea of an eternal rock band, and we'd been around and weathered so much for so many years. But again, I kind of have to, I owe Tim a lot, I think, for leaving ultimately, because it sent me on this new journey, I suppose.
In the immortal words of Sheryl Crow, change will do you good.
Ah.
Or in the immortal words of Tears of Fears, change, you can change. In fact, I'm trying
look to the pop musicians for wisdom,
I'm
folks.
I'm trying to think about how to think about this. So you go solo. Now, this is interesting to me because as you describe it, you've been this guy, Canadians know you, a lot of Canadians know you, you've been performing for many years on stage, but you've actually never been a solo performer. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole new vulnerability to this. Tell me about the first time getting up on stage as a solo guy post-Rheostatics.
Yeah, our first show was actually at the Maple Leaf Tavern on Maiden Lane in London, which to me is like a Canadian tavern designed by someone who's actually never visited Canada. You know, there's like a big Mountie uniform under glass and old, you know, Winnipeg Jets movies on television and stuff, and the obligatory totem poles.
Old Winnipeg Jets movies?
Well, video highlights and stuff too. Yeah, so that part of it was
Winnipeg
actually
Jets
good.
Games. That's awesome.
That was pretty good.
That's very and odd.
I know. Yeah. Who figured you have to
they
go
couldn't
London?
Get videotapes of more recent games.
Somebody had a box lying around, I guess.
Okay.
So no, but that first gig, it was, you know, there was literally nothing on stage. It was, you know, a direct box, a couple of crappy monitors, and a crummy PA that they'd rented for the event, and you know, again, with the Rios, we were used to beautiful stage sound and beautiful PA and everything sounding generally pretty good all the time. And, you know, my voice sounded like the speaker, the sound coming out of the speaker on my kid's close and play record, you know, device. And people looked at me with these bored kind of perplexed looks on their faces, which
even
was
at the
really,
Maple Leaf Tavern, they didn't know who you were.
Yeah, it was Thanksgiving Day, so you had a lot of. It wasn't just Canadians there, but it was a lot right. of people, international people, and even you know, investment bankers who work in London, really, right. or investment bankers who work anywhere, really don't have a great sense of the Rheostatics. So it's not like well, there are a few right. people who sort of knew me, but yeah, it was a horrible experience, but exactly the kind that I desired, I think, strangely, at that point.
And here's an interesting paradox. So you put yourself out there. You're going to go on this tour. You throw yourself into places, and the tour is going to take you all various places in the world, which I want to talk to you about. But you go solo. This is all about letting yourself be vulnerable. And then when you're in that situation on stage, you do anything mm-hmm. to get people to like you. So you end up playing some covers. You know, you just resort to whatever you have to do. Tell me about that moment where you're on stage where you're just going, man, I better play a Neil Young song or something by The Who so that people will like me.
Yes, the entertainer in me, Gian, right. you know, resorting to desperate measures to try to curry favor with the crowd. But actually, that show I'd pretty much stuck to repertoire. It was in St. Petersburg, I think, where we were traveling around and we played at this small bar called The Cynic. And we showed up and the person the day before had told us to come and there'd be a gig, and of course we showed up and there was nothing. There was no speakers, there was no iBox, there was nothing. Nobody was even aware there was a show. So it was funny, me and my friend Alan Pickens, we basically roved around the tables and played, you know, Camper Van Beethoven songs to a bunch of international students from America, basically. But you know what it's like, you know, once you're in the barrel, right, once you're in the moment of the gig, you kind of have to make the best of it. And those, again, that kind of harkens back to the early days of the Rios when there would be 10, 12 people and you just had to make something out of nothing. That's the great challenge. That's where you really find out whether you want to do this for the rest of your life or not.
You went all over the place. Helsinki, Moscow, Shanghai. Did you find there were cultural differences in terms of the audience-musician relationship?
Yeah, and I was surprised, you know. China was particularly interesting because we played in Suzhou, which is a suburb just an hour north of Shanghai. It's like a giant Bramley gone mad. Lots of poured concrete, you know, very strange. And we showed up, and there was about...
I thought Bramley was a giant Bramley.
Well, yeah, no, Brampton's a giant Bramley. Again, more local. But, no, we showed up, and there was about, you know, 300 white bucket chairs laid out on this common, and this stage, and actually, when I thought I'd test the stage when I climbed onto it midday, and so I jumped, knowing that there would be some jumping involved later in the day, and I went through, and for the duration of the show, there was a pinging of a hammer underneath the stage, some poor guy standing underneath us trying to fix it while we were playing.
Right.
But that crowd had never seen a rock and roll band before, and at one point, you know, I resorted to horrible stadia rock histrionics, tried to get the crowd to clap on the two and the four, and said they broke out into wild applause, which actually worked really well. But so we thought all of China would be like that, and then we went to Changsha in the dirty Hunan province, where where, you know, things are more modest. The boom hasn't quite glommed onto that part of China yet. And the crowd was wild, you know. With the first song, 50 kids had jumped up on stage and were going crazy. And the musicians we play with had really bad teeth and greasy hair and marijuana leaf wristbands. So it was great to find that essence of rock and roll in a place that we didn't really think we would. You know, and of course, getting back to your original question, every place was
not
really
such
different.
Exciting times necessarily. Well, a different kind of excitement in Finland, but you did think that Finland. You saw some similarities between Finland and Canada when you were in Finland.
Yeah, I think the Finns are how Canada, how we see ourselves, but aren't really. The Finns are far more timid and quiet. And, you know, conservative and withdrawn. I mean, for me, being a Canadian traveling in Finland, I felt like a loutish Buffalonian. I was really proud of my, like, American side, if that's possible, right? Until we got to the hotel.
Who brought the loud guy?
Yeah. And, you know, it took them a while, but eventually I think they like the loud guy, and so I played that for all it was worth.
I mean, notwithstanding when you feel like a loudish American or that side of you, did you feel like a Canadian ambassador when you're in all these places? Did you feel the weight of representing our country, even that as you are an unknown solo musician in some of these places?
Yeah, you do. I mean, when you go to these places, especially when I was in Freetown in Sierra Leone, I recorded with these hip-hop guys there who are sponsored by War Child, they should say. They do a great job helping these guys out down there. They've got a youth organization. They make records. And so I was in the studio, Studio D, which they basically squatted in this building that had been torched by the rebels when they marched through in 98-99, and it was a closet painted blue, and of course, like any African musical event, immediately like 75 people are there, right? So everybody poured into the studio. They turned off the fans, and I lay down this track to this kind of electronic hip hop sort of this hip hop kind of stew thing that they'd confected on their laptop, and it came time for me to do the track. So I did this one track, and I kind of played as I thought maybe an African guitar player would, so I did a little run. And listening to it back, I realized that was probably disingenuous of me. So I begged for a final take, and they gave it to me, and I just BTO'd them, you know. And listening back, it was fat bar chords laid on the two and four.
Bringing the Canada, the prairie rock.
And I felt those guys sitting on my shoulder, you know. I was rushed, I was BTO, I was tragically hip, all in that one moment. And I also want, when you're away, you want to leave a good impression of what the sensibility of a Canadian musician. So those were some of my favorite moments.
That's a great story. I'm glad you mentioned Africa and War Child, because you were there, the Africa part, you were there as part of doing the charitable work with War Child Canada. And we've got a recording of a performance you did in a refugee camp outside of Accra in Ghana with the Liberian dance troupe. Let's listen to a bit of that.
We gather inside to spark up a fire.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but is that young Ghanaians singing along to you, Holy Mackinac Joe?
Well, Liberians, actually.
Liberians.
Displaced Liberians. Yeah, they were the anti-Finland, basically, in terms of a crowd, you know. And yeah, there were six drummers who were part of this troupe, and they all played along. And you know, as soon as I hit that first chorus, like it was beautiful. Everybody was out of their chair. I remember this one woman, you know, in a traditional African robes and an African turban, and she stood up and she, you know, clenched her fists and she raised them in the air and she tilted her hair back and she just started wailing this, you know, hoser, you know, prairie rock anthem. And it was very edifying in a way, knowing that kind of stuff can translate to
bridge the gap.
Most foreign circumstances.
Amazing. And so often we've talked about it on this show too, the notion that we as Canadians, with our inferiority complex at times, you know, that these songs are too Canadian, people say, you know, it would never translate beyond the borders. Forget the United States. Here you are in Ghana and you're singing along to horses, you know, I mean.
Well, I always thought, you know, bands would come here, tour WOMAD, and you know, World Beat was a big thing for a while, and, you know, we would go see, you know, Ukrainian folk singers and African musicians, and we would treat them very, you know, absorb the music as if something so strange and exotic. But Canadian music displaced in other countries is just as exotic to them as they are to us. And I had always suspected that, and it was good to see that in full color and the brightness of sound.
You feel like you grew as a, I mean, the inevitable, what did you learn? But I mean, right. do you feel this was an experience of a lifetime that you've come back a changed Dave Bedini?
Oh, I don't think I've changed. I think it just, you know, maybe I'm just more Bedini than ever before, actually, for that. And I think it's a, maybe if there's a lesson, I think for any artist is it's to, you wander off that track where you're most accepted, go to the places where you're least accepted. That's how you're really going to discover who you are as a person as an artist, I think.
I've got to wrap this up. I've got 15 seconds here with you, but I know you've been around the country. I saw you in Calgary a couple of weeks ago doing a reading with your new book at WordFest, but you're also doing a performance in Toronto at Pages Bookstore on Saturday, November 10th, where you're reading the entire book and playing some music. Presumably this is going to take hours.
I'm giving it away. Yeah. I don't know.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm in the window. I'm in the window. It's a living window display. That's right across from Much Music.
So this is art.
I will see.
In a window. But you are going to read the entire book and play, augment it with songs.
I think I will.
How long do you think this is going to take you?
I don't know. Maybe 4 days. But actually, we only have 6 hours, so I better finish it by then.
Right, you'll read fast. Yeah. The tour wasn't enough. You need to up the ante.
And the next performance, I'm sure I'll be reading in a box somewhere. So even further withdrawn, but you know.
A Dave Bedini solo album coming out soon?
Yeah, it's recorded. We just got to get it going.
Looking forward to it.
And
it's
the Five Hole on tour in 2008.
It's great to have you here, my
friend. Yeah, great. Amazing.
Dave Bedini, Around the World in 57 and a Half Gigs is the name of the book. It's published by McClellan and Stewart.
This is Q, the podcast. We're on CBC Radio 1 twice each weekday after local and regional noon programs, and again at 10 p.m., 10:30 in Newfoundland.
Okay, well, I'm about to have a conversation with the controversial New York artist Andre Serrano. We are reaching him now. His work deals with subjects like sex, death, and religion. So we want to give Q listeners a heads up on this one. There may be language in the interview that some of you might find graphic, so consider this our first ever Q listener discretion warning. They came with axes and crowbars and a video camera. Four masked men, allegedly members of a neo-Nazi group, broke into an art gallery in Lund, Sweden, to smash the photographs hanging on the walls. Well, the sounds you're hearing right now, the shattered glass, the death metal, comes from a video the vandals posted on YouTube. After they finished, half the exhibit, called A History of Sex, had been destroyed, over $200,000 worth of damage. The images under attack were of people having various forms of extreme sex, straight and gay. Paul O'Mahony is a reporter with the local and English language paper in Sweden. Here's how he describes the initial public reaction to the show before the break-in.
People have been somewhat critical of the exhibition. Just reading comments in newspapers, people thought that the pictures were too extreme and that children shouldn't be allowed to see them.
A History of Sex was created by American artist Andre Serrano. He's already a controversial figure for the debate around his 1987 work, Piss Christ, his photograph of a crucifix submerged in a jar of his own urine. Serrano continues to make art and to incite debate about decency and art. And Andre Serrano is in our New York studio. Hello, sir.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. What was your reaction to news of the attack in Lund a few weeks back?
Well, I was shocked because I had been to Lund to the opening, and the reaction had been very positive. The people, the audience was very diverse. There were very old people, there were very young people, and there were people in between. And everyone was very enthusiastic about the show and supportive and said how much they liked it. And I did a lot of press. Now, I don't read Swedish, so I don't know what was said in the press, but I was told that most of it was very positive.
Well, how would you describe the images in A History of Sex to someone who hasn't seen them before, to our listening audience?
A History of Sex was meant to address sex, you know, because my work is has addressed issues such as race, homelessness, religion, and death, and so I felt like I never covered sex, and so I wanted to do sexual images, but I didn't want it to be. I didn't want them to be erotic photography. And by what I mean by erotic photography is normally, you know, you think of erotic photography as black and white pictures of nudes or maybe even male nudes, but still pictures that are somewhat classical and almost like cliché-ish.
Right,
so
right.
In addressing a discussion of sex, you know, I felt that I had to, you know, cover hardcore images as well.
So what do you mean by hardcore?
I mean, you know, there's a picture called The Fisting. There's a piss picture, a woman pissing into a man's mouth, which is actually a very famous image that was initially the part of another controversy when this show first opened 10 years ago at the Groningen Museum in Holland. There, the controversy surrounded the piss picture that was chosen by the museum as the poster.
Right.
And so eventually, though, it brought 90,000 people to see the show.
So you say you wanted to cover sex because you've covered other areas like race and homelessness. Did you have a particular intent with this exhibit when you first created it with these photographs?
Not at all. You know, I had certain ideas of what I wanted to do. A nude, you know, an older woman with a younger man. And so, as I started to do the work, which I did in Holland, ideas would come to me. And some of those images, things that I actually saw elsewhere, for instance, in Holland, in Amsterdam, many of those images, I'm talking about images of bestiality, of fisting and piss pictures, you know, you'd see them in the windows of the porn stores. Mm. And so you don't even have to go inside the store to see all that stuff, you know. It's in the windows. But the only people gawking are the tourists because the people who live there, they pass it by. Mm. They don't pay any attention to it.
But if you're talking about porn stores and you're saying that you wanted to do something that wasn't traditional erotica in photography, how are the photographs in A History of Sex different from pornography?
Well, they're different in that I think of pornography as being serving a function, and that function is to appeal to prurient interests. But my pictures, they're not meant as images for masturbations. You know, they're meant as they're seductive, but they don't have that sexual quality about them that would make them pornography.
that's quite a fine line, I would imagine. I mean, if they're not to titillate or if they don't have a prurient nature, how is it that you want to affect the way we think about sex with these
people? Well, they have an aesthetic mission, you know. Mm. As an artist, my agenda is only to make art, to create art. And so that's the function of these photographs. They're seductive, they're beautiful, and, the composition, is very nice. And so they're meant, they're constructed as works of art for a different audience.
I'm sort of focusing on this because it's obviously at the crux of the controversy around your work, this exhibit, outside of the fact that it was attacked and vandalized. You know, and I'm thinking about the Swedish journalist there saying that people were reacting to it being too extreme. How do you approach the subject matter when you're doing something like this differently from a porn photographer?
Well, again, I was there, and no one said to me they're too extreme at all. You know, and again, I don't know what the press wrote, but I know there was a lot of coverage. There's a lot of pictures of the exhibition. And so, I don't know what too extreme means, though, because these things, they're all in this sort of public consciousness. They're images that they abound everywhere. You see them, particularly in porn stores on the internet. But in any graphic discussion of sex, these things tend to come up. And so, but like I said, I didn't see any evidence of any nervousness on the part of the museum or on the part of the audience, because everyone that was there was very positive about it.
Right. And some of the images they're certainly compelling. Some of them are quite beautiful. Some are, extreme is an appropriate word. The Vandal video claims that the Kulturen Gallery encourages parents to bring their children to your show. Is that right?
I don't know. But, I feel my work, and I'm talking about a lot, you know, other pictures as well. For instance, I'm thinking particularly of the morgue. I remember years ago when I first showed the morgue in Paris at Yvonne Lambert Gallery in 1992, there was a lady there with her child, and the child was about 3 years old. And she came up to me and she said to me, you know, we've been looking at all the pictures, and this was of the morgue, of dead people in a morgue. And she said to me, you know, he explained to me what all the pictures meant. In other words, he had his own ideas, fantasies, and it was, you know, an opportunity to have a dialogue with the parent. Mm. It's the same thing with the sex pictures. You know, someone very young could look at them and inquire and have a, you know, have a dialogue with the parent. Children are not born to fear images and ideas. It's only when you instill this negative threatening atmosphere that they begin to fear these things. But otherwise, they have natural curiosity.
But Andre, do you think a gallery has a responsibility to warn patrons about the explicit nature of your images before they enter?
Absolutely, if they feel they have to. I mean, in the Groninger Museum at the time we had the sex pictures there, there was, a warning inside outside the entrance to the exhibit, warning, people and saying that children should be admitted only with their parents.
We got a letter from after we reported on what happened in Lund, Sweden. We had a bunch of mail that came into the show. One gentleman, Kevin O'Brien from Cornwall, wrote and said, you know, I really think you need a discussion on this, and which is one of the reasons we're doing this. But he talked about context and how important that is in his letter. And he says, let's agree that if those images were on the wall of a high school gym, they would have no redeeming social value at all, no matter how artful the photography. I have a specific context in mind. It was a family exhibition with a specific encouragement for families to bring children. And he also says this is not a defense for vandals. Do you understand the point about context, and how would you respond to what Kevin O'Brien was saying?
Well, I would say that, first of all, the Kulturin has had other sex shows before. In fact, at the time of my exhibition, there was a sex show, another sex show upstairs containing sexual images. And so the museum obviously has had sexual exhibitions before, and no one has gone in there and vandalized it.
But you agree that if it was on the wall of a high school gym, it would have a different context? Or do you? Do you think it makes a difference if it's in a museum?
Exactly. Tell me what the difference is.
I'm asking you.
Yes, an exhibition in a high school is different than in a museum. For one thing, in a high school, you won't have high-priced art, probably. Showing.
Right. I think the letter writer was probably saying not an exhibition in a high school, but that if you take the photographs and put them anywhere out of the context of an exhibition in a museum, they're going to have a different impact and different implications.
Well, that's true of all, a lot of art. A lot of art, especially contemporary art, you take it out of the museum and galleries and you put it somewhere else, and it has a different response because there's a different audience, and sometimes that audience is not used to looking at art, contemporary art.
Fair enough. Are you surprised that your art so often provokes people?
I'm surprised because it's not expected, but at the same time, once it happens, I've gone through this before, so it's not a big shocker.
Is it your intent to provoke?
No, it's not my intent. My intent is to make beautiful images and also strong images, images that will stay with the person, will stay with the viewer or audience, or images that will have an impact on the viewer in some way, hopefully a positive impact. But a lot of times, you know, we remember the things that disturb us more than the things that please us.
But how do you feel about conversations like this? I mean, I guess, do you think that the public debate created by some of your works is a measure of success, just to have the debate?
I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it, I hate to say it, but I think that's a part of me feels that that's how strong the work is, that even neo-Nazis can't ignore it.
This event in Lund must bring back memories of the late 80s and the controversy created by Piss Christ. How did that event change you?
Well, it changed me in many ways. On a personal level, it affected me both in a positive and negative way. the negative was that it destroyed my marriage because, you know, I had been very isolated individual in the art world and very happily married to a woman by the name of Julie Ault. And after the controversy, I couldn't live that sheltered life anymore, and I had to go out into the real world, so to speak, as an artist, and so I just couldn't manage a relationship at the same time. And so that was the negative, that I felt like a caged animal after the controversy, and I had to, you know, go away from my own wife. But other than that, it was positive in terms of my career. It was very positive.
But you've also said the Piss Christ controversy made you reclusive.
Yeah, you know, and in fact, a lot of times, you know, I feel that the need to withdraw, particularly at moments like this. I mean, fortunately, not too many people have called me about this incident. But a lot of times I feel, particularly with the Piss Christ controversy, I felt that it was a circus of its own. And, you know, it didn't need me to like, shape the controversy in any way. In fact, I prefer to stay away from it.
But you did agree to talk to us. Why is it important for you to talk to the public again by doing interviews like this?
Well, you know, because, you know, I guess it's good to hear from the artist once in a while. But, you know, a lot of times I feel, well, I always think that the work should speak for itself. And in this case, it's an issue, and it's a big problem that the Kulturin had to deal with. And so, you know, I prefer for them to you know, tell the press what they wanted to tell the press and to, you know, and to inform them as to their plans, because I'm not really aware. I think the exhibition opened up yesterday for a few hours with the damaged works, but now only the undamaged works are up until a couple of weeks from now when the reprinted works will arrive in Sweden.
Well, on that note, and before I let you go, I want to play a clip from Vivica Olsson, the curator at the Kulturen Gallery in Lund, Sweden. Here's what she had to say about how the attack on your work has affected the gallery.
The museum has changed. You do when somebody come in and destroy very violently. You change. Of course, people, we are afraid that they are coming back. And on the other hand, we have to have the show open. So that is a dilemma, because we don't want them to win. We don't want anybody else to decide what we can show or not show.
That was Vivica Olsson, the curator at the Kulturen Gallery in Lund, Sweden. Andre Serrano, where does A History of Sex go from here?
It goes to another museum in Sweden, and that museum has already said that they will take it and add security to it, and so they don't anticipate a problem. And this is very important that the museums are showing strength and lack of fear in a situation which is, you know, not a pleasant or safe situation for anyone.
Thanks for joining us today. It's much appreciated.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Andre Serrano is the legendary New York-based photographer behind A History of Sex, which we can confirm will soon be remounted in its entirety at the Kulturen Gallery in Lund, Sweden. He was in our New York studio. And of course, we always want to hear what you think, dear Q listeners. Have you encountered a piece of art that made you think about the line between provocative and obscene? Are you picking up what Andre Serrano is putting down? Give us your thoughts. Q@cbc.ca. You've been listening to Q, the podcast. Hey, you can hear Q, the program, every weekday afternoon and evening on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Gian Gomeshi. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.